Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, continuing with our series of conversations with remarkable minds, the Mueller Report, and the deep state exposed in the Trump years, my guest, Danny Sheehan. Danny is one of our nation's most important and influential constitutional and public interest lawyers. During the past 45 years, he has handled such public interest cases as the Pentagon Papers, the Watergate break-in, Iran-Contra, and the Karen Silkwood murder case. He has represented victims of the Three Mile Island nuclear disaster, as well as fighting against the American Nazi Party on hate crimes. Recently, Danny has been a lead attorney on behalf of the Native Nations at Standing Rock and handling the dismissal of a case against Chase Iron Eyes for inciting a riot and felony trespassing. He is the founder of the Christic Institute and the Romero Institute, the latter being a nonprofit public policy center in Santa Cruz, California. Danny holds a law degree from Harvard University, where he later returned to do additional graduate work at Harvard Divinity School. He is the author of The People's Advocate, and his websites are Daniel P. Sheehan, that's SHEEHAN.com, and Romero Institute.org. Nice to have you with us today, Danny.
Terrific, Gary. It's great to be here.
Danny, the Mueller report has been released, and I've chosen not up to this point to address it. And I'd like you to put this into the larger context of our previous conversations regarding the deep state's influence in Washington politics. Mueller is aligned with the deep state as a former FBI head and someone whose career has been in U.S. intelligence. In the past, it was the Democratic Party that challenged America's intelligence agencies and tried to hold them to scrutiny. But during this entire charade of Russian paranoia with interfering in our elections and colluding to have Trump elected, the Democrats have befriended the deep state, in my opinion. So please first provide your assessment of the Mueller episode and what are the most important lessons we can draw from it. And I might add one additional point, and that is, it is my belief that had anyone else been elected president, Clinton or any other person, left or right, we would never have known at how much control the deep state characters have over the media, have over our legislative process, and many of their crimes and misdemeanors would have been hidden, as they historically have been. Because during the, well, with the exception of the Eisenhower administration, virtually every administration since that time, we have never once, except for the Church hearings, and nothing came from that, we have never once held people, the head of the CIA, the head of the national security agencies, and the people engaging in black op operations and Operation COINTELPRO, not once has a single person been held accountable for crimes against humanity. Not a single person was held accountable for the major crimes during the Vietnam War, like the Phoenix Program, or later the takeover of Libya and the destruction of that country. Never once have these people within the military-industrial complex been held accountable for having scared Americans and using their legislators to try to say we need more money for defense, more money for security, when according to the best estimates I have, above the line it's $740 billion, below the line it's nearly the same amount of money, and they have become a power to themselves, accountable virtually to no one. And now we should ask ourselves, was Trump's election, forget what you think of Trump. Many people don't like Trump. They think he's as close to an imbecile in human form as you can get. But set any personal biases aside, I believe that had anyone else been elected, especially Hillary Clinton, we would never know how pernicious and how metastasizing into our public policy institutes, think tanks, and governmental agencies the deep state has embedded itself. How much control it's had over the media, especially the mainstream media, the puppets on MSNBC and CNN and many of the other networks, even in the alternative media. So I believe that on one hand, as bad as Trump has been on so many policies, at least their lack of control initially over him caused them to overreact and show their hand. And now, for the first time, we know who they are. That's my perspective, but I'm here to hear yours. The forum is yours.
Well, that is extremely interesting because I've been teaching a course since the beginning of this thing at the University of California in Santa Cruz called The Trajectory of Justice. And this particular session, this spring quarter session, is about the impeachment and the relationship that this impeachment process has to the issue of global climate change and the confrontation between the indigenous people and the major oil corporations. And the subtext of this course, I'll get to the main feature of the course, but the subtext of this course has been this very issue, that people, the Democratic Party people, and even the most progressive elements of the Democratic Party have really fallen for this effort on the part of a major element in the leadership of the national security state, FBI, the Five Squad, you know, their whole Division Five, the counterintelligence and domestic security, the CIA operations inside the United States led by Jack Brennan, all of these groups, their withering campaign against Trump, setting aside the major question about whether it was justified or not, the inappropriateness of this element, the national security state people, engaging in this type of a coordinated effort to undermine a president and to challenge his authority, to actually encourage members of the executive branch to disobey his direct orders, the use of the Justice Department in their grand jury system to go after him, to basically open a star chamber proceeding against him, saying, you know, here's who we're after. Anybody who's got any complaints about him, from whether he, you know, has prostitutes pee on him or they order them to pee on beds, all the way to his income tax returns, to, you know, whether he beats his dog, you know, is just an astonishing display of power on the part of the national security state and their infrastructure. And the cheering that's going on for them now on the part of the Democratic Party, after many of us have spent so many years trying to raise profound questions about the inappropriateness of the power that has come to reside in the national security state. And one of the things I point out to people is to say, just imagine that if, in fact, Bernie Sanders had actually won the Democratic Party nomination because the DNC and the Clinton campaign had not so closely coordinated, you know, crunching him in the primary process. If he had won and been elected president, just imagine what the national security state people would have been doing against him, you know, just constantly going crazy, you know, about his, you know, speaking favorably on behalf of Cuba, for example, or, you know, criticizing United States foreign policy against Russia, or their attitudes toward Venezuela. So, but it's very hard for 99.9% of the people to see this particular problem here. And I've been discussing with my students, you know, let's take a look at this. You know, what do you think about this peculiar kind of avalanche of activity toward the president, no matter what you think of him? You know, I mean, it's a little hard because, you know, other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you like to play? I mean, it is true that this guy is a danger to the country. But very importantly, he's a danger to the long-term imperial ambitions and activities of the national security state of the United States. This entire set of policies that have evolved since basically the robber baron era that we've talked about so many times on your show, that whole rise of the United States into a major world power, economic and military power, in their unbridled and undisguised ambition to establish hegemony, you know, economic and military, cultural and social hegemony over all the world is transparent on the face of it. And it is true that when Trump was elected, the Republican Party, officialdom sort of held their breath and said, look, let's see if we can get him to reduce the income tax for wealthy people. Let's see if we can get him to eliminate the state tax. Let's see if we can get him to appoint 236 federal judges. Let's fill in the 140 judges that were left vacant, you know, because of the boycott that was engineered by the Senate Republican-led Senate Judiciary Committee to block any hearings at all on 140 different appointments to the federal bench, and then create 56 new federal judgeships. You know, that let's take a look at what it is that's happening right now. The fact is that the institutions that have been set up, the protocols that they like to talk about, the norms that have been set up by the national security state and their relationships with the national news media, you know, there are numerous people that are on the staffs of the New York Times, the Washington Post, the major networks, you know, who are, quote, national security reporters, virtually all of whom come from the national security state, you know, are in almost all the people you see being interviewed by MSNBC, you know, are, you know, the chief of staff of the CIA and the chief of staff of the FBI, the heads of counterintelligence in the FBI, you know, the parade of people that are being tendered as the heroes protecting the state against the president are all hardcore right-wing national security state advocates. And most people aren't seeing that. They're blinded by the fact that Trump is such an idiot, you know, and he is so reckless. But what he's really endangering is the long-term program that has been engineered by the national security state to kind of foist its power and influence on the rest of the world. And he's wreaking havoc with that. And the problem is he isn't even really doing it from any particular ideological perspective. He's just ignorant and kind of a moron. And it's like having an infant, you know, being given a set of very sharp knives for his second birthday, you know, or loaded guns. And he's just recklessly endangering their program that they've had underway all this time. Now, very importantly, we don't want to lose sight of the fact that he's also endangering some of the most fundamental constitutional precepts of our country. That's kind of uppermost in a lot of people's minds, to the point where it's blinding them as to what the interests are that he's interfering with. Very importantly, one of the things we've talked about in previous shows is that when Mikhail Gorbachev agreed back in 1991 to release all of the republics of the Soviet Union from their bound obligation to be part of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, that there was a specific agreement that was granted by George Bush Sr. and his Secretary of State, at that time James Baker. They agreed with Gorbachev that they would never try to recruit any of the former Russian republics into NATO. And yet, as soon as Bush Jr. got in, when W. Bush got in with his vice president of Dick Cheney, they immediately set upon this campaign of recruiting every single one of the republics on the borders and boundaries of the former Soviet Union to become members of NATO. and we're actually talking about placing, you know, ballistic missiles in all of those countries. And it was when they finally decided they were going to close almost the entire encirclement of Russia on their western border by doing the same thing in the Ukraine, sending in Central Intelligence Agency undercover operations to oust the Russian-leaning and Russian-favored president in the Ukraine and destabilize the whole place. That's when Putin, you know, sent in military people into the eastern half of Ukraine and basically protected their only warm water port to the sea. And yet that's not being talked about at all. You don't hear anybody talking about that in MSNBC or CNN or any of the networks or the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post. You don't hear any of that discussion going on. They all sort of fell into lockstep behind that policy, even though it was this hardcore anti-Russian kind of xenophobic attitude toward Russia that was part of Dick Cheney's worldview in the Project for a New American Century. But it was taken up by Barack Obama and taken up by his Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. And they continued that same policy. And they were the ones that ran headlong into the response on the part of Putin in the Ukraine. Now, this is the kind of overarching superstructure of what's really going on here at the end of the Cold War, when Mikhail Gorbachev realized that it was finally time to alleviate this threat hanging over the entire human species of a potential thermonuclear war between the Soviet Union and the United States, and agreed to step back from that 75-year Cold War, and elicited a specific agreement on the part of then-President Bush Sr. and James Baker that they would not take advantage of them and allow a time of peace to prevail. As you know, we were actively involved in the State of the World Forum at the end of that Cold War to try to establish some sort of a new order, some new paradigm pursuant to which Russia and the United States could agree and be cooperative in some way that would profit and help the whole world. But that didn't work because W. Bush and his whole administration went immediately obviously they were following up on the fact that Bush Sr. had, the minute he started to learn that the Soviet Union was potentially getting ready to make this concession and step back from the Cold War, he mounted a major invasion to occupy the Middle Eastern oil fields. And that's what all of this is about, the invasion on the part of George Bush Sr. under the disguise of Saddam Hussein, getting ready to invade and occupy not only Kuwait, but allegedly Saudi Arabia. We've talked about that before. It was all a total fraud. And we know that the invasion of the second Gulf War on the part of W. Bush and Dick Cheney on the complete hoax that Iraq had nuclear weapons and weapons of mass destruction and was going to be launching a unilateral military attack against the United States. It's been shown just completely that was a fraud. And yet people are still saying, well, you know, we've invaded them, we've occupied them, we might as well stay there. Or worse yet, it would be irresponsible for us to leave without reestablishing the entire country and that whole region of the world in a way that benefits us to have access to their oil. So this is the larger strategic overview of what's going on here. And to have a person, whether it was going to be Donald Trump or it was going to be possibly be someone else who was going to be uncooperative with that longer-term agenda that was going on, for example, Bernie Sanders, that what's happened is the national security state, they're a lot more dangerous than just any other bureaucracy. I mean, there's always this argument about the government has this bureaucratic imperative, everything from the State Department to the Department of Treasury to the Department of Transportation. They all develop this bureaucratic imperative that they have to try to serve their own bureaucratic interests. But when you have a national security state bureaucracy, such as the Central Intelligence Agency, the National Security Agency, the Defense Intelligence Agency, DISC, the Defense Industrial Security Command, these alphabet soup national security agencies, they're a lot more dangerous than just any old bureaucracy. And when they start developing their own foreign policy initiative that's going to continue no matter who becomes president, that anybody who comes into office and attempts to interfere in that agenda is going to be attacked. We've talked in the past, for example, about Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter was clearly ousted from the presidency by this same group. This is what happened to the October surprise that happened in 1980. It was Bush Sr., who was the vice presidential candidate with Ronald Reagan. In his campaign staff was Theodore Shackley, his former director of covert operations. When Bush Sr. was the director of the CIA, they choreographed the entire importation of billions of dollars coming in from the Nugentan Bank in Australia, which had been skimmed off the sale of opium in Southeast Asia. And everybody with a political IQ above room temperature in Washington, D.C. knows this is true, and brought that money into the United States to fund the campaign against Jimmy Carter and to knock off Frank Church, who was the chairman of the Church Committee that you made passing reference to in the beginning, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence Abuse, chaired by Frank Church of Idaho. They put in millions of dollars into his campaign. This is the former CIA covert operations director under George Bush Sr., put in millions of dollars into the campaign in the U.S. Senate against Frank Church up in Idaho, you know, publicizing the fact that he supported the Equal Rights Amendment, publicizing the fact that he supported some restrictions on automatic weapons. They also went after Dick Clark of Iowa because he had opposed CIA covert operations in Africa. They went after three other United States senators, you know, Alan Cranston in California, George McGovern in South Dakota, and Birch Bayh in Indiana. They got Birch Bayh, they got Dick Clark, they got Frank Church. This was a direct, active interference inside the United States presidential and senatorial elections by the covert operations division of the Central Intelligence Agency. You know, and so that this danger that has been posed to our constitutional democracy by the creation of a covert espionage agency like the CIA, it was warned against back in 1947 when this was proposed at the end of the Cold War, at the end of World War II, that people warned you can't create an operation like this. It's just like the KGB in Russia. If you allow a criminal covert operation like this to be going on under the rationale that, oh, they're only going to overthrow governments outside of the country, they're only going to be assassinating foreign leaders, not ours, you know. But the fact of the matter is, when you create such a bureaucracy, they have a tendency to develop the same kind of bureaucratic imperative that any other bureaucracy does, except that they're extraordinarily dangerous because they view themselves as having been green-lighted to overthrow governments and to destroy the political careers of people who oppose them. And that's exactly what they've done. And we see them doing this now with Donald Trump. And the thing that makes it so extremely confusing for people is because it's perfectly clear that Donald Trump is incompetent. It's perfectly clear that he's reckless. It's perfectly clear that he's ignorant and lazy and refuses to perform the clear duties and responsibilities of a responsible president of the United States. And so he should, in fact, be removed. But this is not the appropriate way to go about doing it. You know, that they need to take very careful steps and remove him. Lawrence Tribe of Harvard University, the leading American constitutional scholar alive today, has laid it out in very clear safe terms about how you go about doing this. He wrote this book called To End a Presidency, The Power of Impeachment. He wrote this book 2 years ago, laying out the careful guidelines that needed to be followed. And the national security state, more or less under the leadership of Jack Brennan, has just waded right into this president and set up a star chamber. And they've enrolled the Department of Justice in this. They've got the FBI involved in this. You know, and when they go to the office of the law office of the lawyer for the president of the United States, his private lawyer, and commandeer virtually every document in his entire place, and then set up a special guy to hear, I'm going to go all through these things, and I'll exclude anything that is obviously a sensitive attorney-client privilege that doesn't have something you want. And the people cheer. The liberals, and even some of the progressives, you know, they stand by and they cheer this going on. This is extraordinarily dangerous. And as I'm saying, is that if, in fact, the Democratic primary right now, which is it's going to shake down to a contest between Joe Biden in the new, more moderate Democratic Party, the post-Cold War, more moderate Democratic Party, you know, of the Democratic Leadership Conference, against Bernie Sanders. And the rest of the people in there are basically competing for cabinet positions, really. I mean, and Bernie Sanders, if he were smart, would back up and say, look, let's get organized here. All of you, let's get clear who we think the cabinet people ought to be. You know, obviously, Elizabeth Warren should be the Secretary of the Treasury. Obviously, Kamala Harris should be the Attorney General. Obviously, Inslee from Washington State should be the head of the Environmental Protection Agency. It's almost as obvious that the Secretary of State should probably be Joe Biden. You know, he's chaired the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He's chaired the Judiciary Committee. He's been around, you know, since he was 29 years old in the Senate. He knows everybody. He's met every national leader.
Danny, yeah. Are those suggestions you're making? Because those sure as hell wouldn't be my suggestions for who should be running our government.
No. The reason I'm saying this is I'm pointing out that what it means is that if, in fact, that were true, and anybody other than Joe Biden were to get elected president, who's, you know, Joe Biden being in on this whole process of what the national security state agenda is, if somebody like Bernie Sanders were to, in fact, become president, he's going to run into the exact same problem.
Except he is more intelligent. Let me interject here for a moment, and I'm going to focus on three separate issues, but they do have a connection.
Uh-huh.
First, let me give my historically, I believe, accurate assessment of Joe Biden, why he would be as dangerous as Barack Obama, and in my opinion, the most dangerous president in our lifetimes. First of all, as a senator from Delaware, deeply tied to the tech consumer credit card side of the banking industry. Why?
I agree.
And why he was called at one time the senator from MBBA before it was bought by BOFA. He was a strong supporter of free trade agreements during Clinton's years, such as NAFTA, which killed union jobs. Mm-hmm. He supported the Trans-Pacific Partnership during Obama years. He voted for the Iraq War. He was chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee at the time. He voted for the Patriot Act, but opposed the Act's wiretapping section. He is a self-described Zionist, and he said on a Jewish TV program, I am a Zionist. You don't have to be a Jew to be a Zionist. You do have to be an idiot, but that's relevant. He was a mouthpiece for AIPAC and the Jewish lobby. He said during a 2008 vice president debate, no one in the United States Senate has been a better friend to Israel than Joe Biden. Okay, are you going to take responsibility for what has become the crisis of the Palestinian people or the undermining of any kind of sense of peace efforts in the Middle East? He was wishy-washy on Russia, both condemned it and then called for cooperation, and now opposes Medicare for All. That immediately should send a flag up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He favored Obamacare, which was, as you and I know, where it's written completely by the insurance industry, and it mm-hmm. was a big, fat, wet kiss to them. He also, on climate change, he's aligned with Gore on carbon emissions cap and trade, and that's a complete fraud. Carbon emissions caps and carbon credits do not stop global warming.
Nope,
they simply allow people who can afford to pay for those to pay for them and keep polluting. He supports capital punishment. And his 1994 Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act created that. He voted for increasing prison sentences and built up local law enforcement into police state and supports the weaponization of the private prison systems. He supports the war on drugs, but wants to move drug possession offenders out of prison. He passed a bill that is has been used by the DEA, harassment of youth in rallies and parties. He said NATO got it right in Libya. Wow. So you, the one place in the world where you can buy slaves openly, the one place where you can get any organ of a body you want because they're coming in every day and they're just taking them out of their kidneys and hearts right out of a people's body. And the number one country in Africa, the jewel of Africa, the Paris of Africa, he totally supported this in complete destruction. He is a hard-headed neocon on everything involving Iran. He was the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He called for sanctions against Iran in the past, but he also has only about a 60% approval rating from the ACLU. So those are some of the reasons why he would be the worst president. He would be Barack Obama incarnate. Now, that's part of what I'm talking about. Here's the second part.
Yeah.
And this is far more interesting from my perspective. Look at Vladimir Putin. He was a colonel in the KGB. He went on to run the KGB. But when he was looking at Yeltsin, and we were finished with Yeltsin, we had supported that drunken lackard, and and he took over because he was someone that we could count upon. He was smart. He's an academic, or not an academic. He's an intellectual. He is. For example, he practices jujitsu and judo. He's a black belt. He works out every day, and he doesn't want war, because war would threaten his small population country, about 135 million people, but twice the size of the United States. They had sanctions, crippling sanctions. You know what he did? He went ahead when he couldn't get apples from Poland and peaches from Romania and other food stocks, he began to grow their own orchards. Guess what? Today, they are food secure and are the world's largest producer of organic, non-GMO produce. But how can a kleptocrat, he is a kleptocrat, he's probably worth somewhere above $40 billion, which would make him the wealthiest man in Europe, and certainly in the
history. About 93 million dollars.
Okay.
Probably worth now.
So that would make him the wealthiest man in the world. Pretty close. Now, here, how did he do it? Well, first of all, he's very smart. Knowing that he has absolute power, he looks at everything in Russia as belonging to him. So he gets people who are his longtime allies. If you look at all the people that came out of the security office, which was just one room in the KGB, there are about 12 guys. Every one of those 12 guys is now an oligarch. So he got his longtime childhood friends, those who had no experience in oil, food, and the person that was one of his friends became the person who would import after the breakup of the Soviet Union, would import all the fruits. So any banana or apple that you ate in Russia, profit went to that oligarch. And that's how the oligarchs became oligarchs. Now, they all sit at this conference table. It's like a round table, if you've ever seen it. And there's about 30 people sitting at this round table. And every single one of them is one of his close friends. Every one of them is a billionaire. You kick back to him, and it's a given. You're paying tribute. He's like Caesar. You have to give back to him. And as a result, he has all of this hidden control, meaning he even has a palace that he built there, and a beautiful palace that cost over $1 billion, making it one of the most expensive homes, if not the most expensive home in the world. And yet, because of his support of these people, if they betray him, he arrests them and put them in jail, and all their money goes. So there's a statement in Russia. It says, you know, to your friends you give everything, to everyone else you give the law. So as a result, he stays in power because everyone who's wealthy supports him, and that's created a financial stability. Massive kleptocracy, massive theft, but always giving something back to the people more than what they would have had otherwise. Now, compare that to the United States, where you don't have a Caesar, but you have people like the Clintons. They're not oligarchs. And you have Trump. He's not an oligarch. And you have the Bushes. They're not oligarchs. but they are the people who are the front faces of power, the real people behind the scenes. Most of the people would never know their names. Yeah, you might know George Soros or the Koch brothers or the Waltons, but you're not going to know 99% of the maybe 165 people that really all are the oligarchs, the people who point people, they select them, they're in power. Virtually every single agency of government, every single one is headed by a technocrat from the business community or the industries that are there, just like Putin puts his people ahead of industries and then has what it once done in his policy. Same thing happens here. So here you got Hillary Clinton. This is the last part. Hillary and Bill Clinton have taken over $12 billion funneled through the Clinton Initiative, Clinton Foundation, for Haiti. That money never got back to Haiti. The Clintons got traded with Russia, and Vladimir Putin got 20% of our uranium. That meant that our entire administration at the State Department, the White House, was cooperating with Russia, the so-called demon of Russia and Vladimir Putin. When Clinton was in office, they were friends. Now, the enemy. Also, the Clintons had every major group. They had all of banking, all of big armaments, the military industrial groups. They had big pharma. They had big agriculture, Monsanto. They had all the grain companies, the feed companies. Virtually every major segment of our society supported the Clintons. Now, the Clintons they're not stupid people intellectually. But we've never had kleptocracy and favor, pay-to-play, as we've had with the Clintons. And so when she didn't get elected and everybody was supporting her, including all the media, what in the heck does that tell you about the integrity of people in the media not seeing what I just explained to you? How could every single industry, how could every banking group, how could every government agency support you unless you were so totally compromised? And all you had to do is look at who's paying the speaking fees of $500,000 for a private 40-minute lecture in Russia that meant nothing, but it was $500,000. That's the payback. And the Clinton Foundation receiving $120 million, that's the payback. So that's it. So now when their person didn't get in office and they've knowingly committed crimes and they had indictable offenses, and yet the Justice Department, through their friends and the power elite, including Mueller and Comey and Lynch and the top people, Rosenfeld and the others at the Justice Department, decide not to prosecute them, but to prosecute Trump and say it was all Russian. That, to me, shows you the power today of the deep state and how it all operates. Your thoughts, please.
Well, it's the knowledge of these things that are going on are sort of the preliminary step that any person whose opinions are going to be considered valuable ought to have. And then the question that arises is, what do we do about this thing? Now, you're devoted to trying to get people, as I'm devoted to trying to get people to understand this first level of information so that they can get out of this kind of mythology that they're all in, that the United States is kind of, you know, fostering and promoting democracy around the world, that in fact, you know, Putin is just this rotten Rasputin character that's kind of mesmerized everybody in Russia and is trying to take over the world. We've got to get out of that first level of ignorance of not only the vast majority of regular people, but even the intelligentsia, you know, are drinking that Kool-Aid. And so that we on the fringes are trying, in the progressive community, are trying to point out to the actual facts of what's going on. And then we have the obligation to take the next step to say, therefore, what are we going to do about this? And we get so caught on trying to get them convinced and to get frustrated with the fact that it's so hard to get people to understand these basic facts that we don't get to the next step to try to explain what we're going to do about this, because there's a good argument that what good does it do to try to explain to people what they ought to do about it if they don't even know what it is you're talking about. And so that what we've been doing in our course, and it's available, we post our classes each day after we do them. I teach on Tuesdays and Thursdays at the University of California at Santa Cruz, and then we post them the next day on Wednesday and Friday. So people can find them at the RomeroInstitute.org under resources, and you just see the classes there. They've got not only this year's spring courses, but previous spring courses that we've talked about, the rulers of the realm and other things that we've done. But this one this year, what we're focusing on is trying to figure out what to do about this. And as I said, the subtext of the course has been this deep concern about the effect of the deep state, and how all the liberals and even some of the progressives are unknowingly sitting around cheering for guys like Comey and guys like Jack Brennan and the people who are the main pillars of this national security state bureaucracy here that we've got going. So what we're trying to do is say, look, what do we need to do about this? I think that Larry Tribe is trying to, he has come to the position now that, look, it is essential that we take legal steps, not these extra legal steps that are being taken by the ganging up on Trump by this star chamber process that's going on with the national security state bureaucracy, but to step back, have the proper authorities in the Judiciary Committee of the House of Representatives look at the objective information that's here and determine whether or not they're going to return articles of impeachment against him, even though under the Republican control of the Senate, that it's very unlikely that they're going to convict him of any of the articles of impeachment. But what that's going to be doing is it's going to be clearly putting forward in front of the American people very specific information and evidence, which goes to show that Donald Trump has been, in fact, actively engaged in facilitating and in promulgating the massive increase in the production and consumption of fossil fuels and petroleum that is, according to all of the major legitimate experts in the world, in at least significantly contributing to this process of global climate change.
Okay, but Danny, hold on a second. Hold on. If you're going to make the mistake of doing that, then you're going to have to go after Bush Jr., Bush Sr., Clinton, yes. Obama.
Yes.
All of them are equally guilty. It's just, let's not, okay, now I got a completely separate, I got a completely, okay, hold on 1 second. I got a completely unrelated question, but my audience wants to know this from you. It concerns the Constitution, and you're a constitutional scholar. What rights do we have to make choices about what affects our body? Whether the food we eat, whether we decide to vaccinate our children or not, and now even more recently the rollout of 5G technology that will affect every single man, woman, and child in the nation 24/7 with 5G. We found 10,000 articles in the peer-reviewed scientific literature challenging its safety and efficacy. And also, we have written 53 articles challenging the science behind the safety and efficacy of vaccines. Is the Constitution at all capable of protecting us so that the government, the state or federal government, cannot mandate forced vaccination? Then it transcends the sanctity of our body, and the government then, in effect, controls our body. And now they're saying in California they want to vaccinate by mandate all adults, and anyone refusing to be vaccinated, according to the Washington Post just this week, should be challenged and arrested. Now, what right, if any, do we have on that level?
This is an extraordinarily important issue that you raise here, and that we should probably have an entire program that we both talk about this. I'll answer it quickly for you, and I want to get back to our other main subject. It's the Ninth Amendment issue. That there's a Ninth Amendment issue that the Madisonians, James Madison was the principal author of these, the so-called Jeffersonians, as distinct from the Hamiltonians that represented the financial and major mercantile interests that put together the Constitution. The Ninth Amendment expressly states, as you know, that just because we've enumerated these specific rights in the previous eight amendments that we've listed here to the original Constitution, it doesn't mean there are not other profound fundamental rights. And I've written articles about this for the Harvard Civil Rights Law Review about the Ninth Amendment and the importance of this. This fundamental right to the privacy of the interior of your own body and extended by that parental rights to the bodies of their children, as distinct from the state, is an extraordinarily important issue, and it's one that I completely agree with you on. And I've met with the major leaders in the issues of the vaccination issue, and I've talked about it. We've had discussions about what can legally be done about this, and so that we need to have a whole show about that. But I agree that that's extraordinarily profound. And the point that you made immediately prior to this comment, that this issue of the role that Trump has played in exacerbating the petroleum industry and the burning of fossil fuels and the contributions to global climate change, it is absolutely true that it isn't just Trump, that in fact the Bushes primarily, you know, and they're major oil people, and that their involvement in literally the Energy Transfer Partners Corporation, you know, that pushed the major oil pipeline through the Dakota territories, you know, that Bush was or Trump was a partner in that. And the Bushes were deeply involved not only in invading and occupying the Middle Eastern oil field, but the whole effort to build a major pipeline, as you know, from the Caspian Sea and the Black Sea all the way down through to the Sea of Arabia. That entire operation that's going on that caused them to be negotiating with the Taliban, but it was what triggered when the Taliban refused to grant the Carlyle Group the right to build that pipeline. They triggered the invasion against them. You know, so we're aware of all those things. But the bottom line is that after the gathering of 193 nations in Paris in December of 2015 and the signing of a resolution of agreement of the 193 nations, the absolute necessity to start seriously cutting back on the expulsion of global climate change generating gases into the atmosphere, to then have Trump come into office and the very second thing that he does after he issues an executive order banning all Islamicists from coming into the United States, no Muslims in the United States anymore. The second thing he does on the second day in office is issues an order ordering the Dakota Access Pipeline to go forward, ordering the Keystone Pipeline to go forward after there have been specific findings, after long evidentiary hearings, that they're in violation of the environmental protection laws. And very importantly, the moving of the pipeline, the Dakota Access Pipeline, from 10 miles north of Bismarck of the 92% white community to right within a half a mile of the 82% Native American community is an absolute violation of the federal Civil Rights Act. So these actions that Trump was taking after the resolution of the Paris Accords that they had, that is an act of defiance, in a knowing defiance of what he's doing. And when you can show, very importantly, when you can show that Donald Trump's entire administration was made up of these oil people, from Rex Tillerson to Rick Perry, to Scott Pruitt, to all of these people are deeply involved in the petroleum industry and the self-serving activity that they've been engaged in, and enriching themselves by fostering and promoting the further development of petroleum in North America. And now they're working together to pass these statutes that criminalize anybody from trying to raise questions about and go on the internet and challenge the legitimacy of these pipelines. They've got all this stuff going on now. This is a massive assault on the part of a person exercising the offices of the presidency to enrich himself. It's not just his laundering money through his Trump Towers. It's not just his engaging in getting loans that from the oligarchs' money deposited in the Deutsche Bank, in Cyprus. What he's doing is he's actively engaged, and they just got through selling, and here's a major issue you'll see if people tune into the classes that I'm teaching on this on our website at RomeroInstitute.org. But the fact is that the biggest sale of one of the major sale of any private company that was owned by Russia in the aftermath of the dissolution of the Cold War, the biggest deal made was the sale of the Russian government-owned oil and gas corporation, this thing Rosneft, and people are missing this entirely. This sale of this to this mysterious group that's called the Intergroup Trust, that nobody knows who those people are. They sold it, and they have the claim to the northern shelf, the Arctic shelf, in the 15-mile economic zone in northern Russia. They've got 87 billion barrels of oil under that shelf. And to get at it, you have to stimulate and increase global climate change to melt the ice on that area. That activity that's being engaged in, you got to understand, it was Carter Page who brokered that sale. And Carter Page and the people that were present at Donald Trump's first foreign policy speech on April 27th of 2016, that was originally scheduled to take place at the National Press Club, was at the last minute on the 25th of April changed to the Mayflower Hotel, and they held his, and it was sponsored by the Center for the National Interest. It's this hardcore conservative group. Henry Kissinger is the honorary chairman of it. Jeff Sessions is on the board. Pete Peterson is on the board of that. And it turns out that Pete Peterson is the co-founder of Blackstone a financial group, along with Stephen Schwartzberg, I think his name is, who is Schwartzman, who's a major economic advisor to Trump. And it turns out that whole deal was negotiated down in with this group down in the Cayman Islands building where they have their offices. And I'm telling you that if you can show that Trump and Putin are part of that partnership of this intergroup trust, that they have just sold the private oil and gas corporation of Russia to this combine, who are personally looking at 87 billion. It's a $10 trillion operation that they're looking at now. And that could explain in great detail why it is that this love relationship is going on between Trump and Putin. And it is to the direct detriment of the entire planet, of destroying the ecological climate system. Now, that is grounds for impeachment. And in a certain sense, it distinguishes him, not in kind, but in degree, from the activities of the Clintons. And it's directly correlated to the very same activities that the Bushes were engaged in.
It actually gets worse than that, because right now Bolton and Pompeo are pushing Trump towards a disastrous war with Iran. So we're right at the level of brinkmanship. And I believe that could be the worst situation to happen in decades, and what that would mean for the world if Iran was attacked, and who would side with Iran, and who would side with Israel and the United States and other countries. That gets my attention immediately, because once you start that conflict, it's not going to go well for anyone, and especially for prices of oil around the world. And the impact of nuclear weapons, even limited nuclear weapons, are used. But Danny, thank you very much for coming on and sharing your insights. We certainly appreciate it. And we look forward to seeing if more information comes out that can put Trump in a deal that he should not have been in, that can contribute to global warming. Contributing to global warming in and of itself, you would have an awful lot of people who would be co-conspirators. I doubt if you're ever going to find Putin, because Putin almost never has anything in his name directly. And yet he has the power, and people pay tribute to him, because if you're his friend, you get everything, and if you're not, you go to jail. Thank you very much, Danny. I appreciate your input.
All right.
Danny Sheehan, and we will bring him back for a one-hour special on how to protect your body and what the Constitution says, so they cannot force us to be penetrated and violated by 5G or by vaccines. Thank you for listening, and have a nice day.
Mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love in here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see. Oh, what's going on? Right on.